This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I am here with Abby Stone from the University of Manchester. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Hi.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing here at the Blue Dot Festival?
Okay, sure. Yeah, today we are introducing people to the concept of the Anthropocene. Are we in a whole new geological era where we have altered the Earth so much that we've left an indelible mark?
And how do you even define a geological era to begin with?
Well, this is an interesting question, actually, because what we've usually done is had everything ready in the rock records. We dig, we find a place where the rock changes very dramatically, or the biological record, the fossils in it change a lot. And we say, that's a big environmental shift, that's a change. So it's actually quite difficult to define something before it's turned to rock. And that's one of our bigger challenges with the Anthropocene. There seems to be a really clear idea that we are changing the Earth enough. Atmospheric gases, plastics in the environment, things from nuclear fallout. But actually being able to dig around and find it until it's become rock is a bit of a challenge. And that's why there's a lot of debate and a lot of argument about exactly whether we're in the Anthropocene, whether it started, and how we should define it, whether it's when we started building pyramids, when we started sedentary agriculture, when we started doing sort of more extreme things to the environment in the Industrial Revolution, for example.
Yeah, and so I guess some of the things that people would obviously think of are things like climate change, but I guess there's less obvious impacts that we're having as well.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, we certainly see, in terms of anthropogenic climate change, and that's really nicely recorded in air bubbles in ice sheets, at the North Pole and the South Pole, we can see really clearly how we have amplified the amount of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. And that's a record where it gets locked into ice, a bit like getting locked into rock. But yes, if you dig around and if you imagine what a landfill site might look like in 10,000 years, what are we going to see that's preserved there? It's probably the stuff that breaks down really slowly, particularly the plastics. We might find loads and loads of stuff that we eat as well. So chicken bones, for example, and other stuff like that. So yes, there's going to be a marker when we come back and dig holes.
No, that's fascinating. And I never even think about, because I think about plastics and stuff being left behind, but chicken bones is something that would never have crossed my mind at all. But I guess when you think about the amount of chicken consumed, it's enormous.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the, I think, quite quirky things that people have picked up on when it comes to working out what our marker will be. I can't remember. I don't actually have any facts on exactly how many chickens, but there are some nice facts out there about where chickens came from and how we've moved them all around the globe and domesticated them and exploded the number of chickens. There wouldn't be so many chickens if there weren't so many humans, basically.
No, that makes sense. And to be honest, I have never considered where chickens originally came from. So that's definitely given me something to think about. So as well as being here to talk about the Anthropocene, you're also a researcher as well. So what's your area of interest?
So I'm interested in deserts mainly. So I'm interested in trying to find out how they've changed through time, kind of why they're there in the first place, whether at certain points of the time they've been less desert-like. And what you find if you dig far enough back in the past, particularly in North Africa, is that there are times actually where the Sahara wasn't very much like the Sahara as we know it today. It was sufficiently wetter that actually people have suggested it was the Green Sahara. So ending around 6,000 years ago, there was enough moisture from the way that the climate has changed naturally through time that actually there were lots of rivers flowing through the sand seas. They became greener. Crocodiles were able to make it from the sub-Sahara right across to the Mediterranean. And you find fossils of fish either side as well. So it was all connected up through green river systems. And this is probably really useful at other points in the past. It's happened time and time again as it's got wetter and drier. During these wetter intervals, you have these green connections across deserts. And our species have made use of that. And they've made use of that during their expansions out of Africa and through the migration patterns that we've taken through the Sahara, through Arabia, at times where it's been wetter in the past. So you can go to deserts and find out a lot about how climate's changed.
No, that's fascinating. And I've never even thought about the human story of that as well. Yeah. One of the questions you asked me earlier, actually, about how much sand do we think we use every day?
Every year.
That was the one. And I just completely guessed at millions of tons, but you blew me away with the actual answer.
Yeah. So the thing is, we use sand for so many things. Obviously, we use it for glass. You melt things down, you make glass bottles. But we use that in electric hobs, chopping boards, our smartphones. We're carrying loads of melted down sand with us every day for the glass screen on our phones, but it's construction. Construction's the thing that accelerates that figure and makes up 60%. Sand makes up 60% of concrete. So the thing that drives that figure is our buildings and our roads. So globally, we're talking about 40 billion tons per year, which is a number I actually find it quite hard to comprehend, even though I work with quite big numbers in some of my research. So I've been trying to work out, in terms of blue whales, how much that would be. It would be 200 million blue whales. And I still can't imagine what 200 million blue whales is. But if we take the Eiffel Tower, that one's quite useful. 5 million Eiffel Towers worth weight of sand is used every year. That's still quite a difficult one, I think, to wrap your head around. And that's twice as much sand moved around the environment, exported. Dubai uses sand from China to build its largest, the tallest building in the world. We as humans move twice as much sand than all the rivers in the world.
That's incredible. Wow. That's, yeah, I think I never realised how much sand is used. And yeah, as soon as you say concrete, I kind of go, oh yeah, I did know that. That makes sense. And so you were saying that Dubai actually imports sand from China as well, which is something that wouldn't seem logical to me, because I would have thought Dubai has a lot of sand. So why would they need to do that?
Well, so yeah, desert sand is one thing. And the problem with desert sand is actually it's a bit too smooth and a bit too round. So if you've been to a desert when it's windy, you get a lot of sand blown up and hitting against your legs, maybe even bouncing high enough to hit you in the face. As the sand is blown around by the wind, all its rough edges get knocked off. So you end up with really smooth, round grains, which don't stick together well. They're useless to make cement. So actually, we need jagged sand. We need the kind of sand that's been knocking around in water and keeps those sharp edges. So sand that we find in rivers, on beaches, and at the bottom of the ocean floor. So Dubai has used all its useful sand from the marine environment to build the massive palm out in the Gulf for real estate, to build those connected world, supposed to be world archipelago, which they still haven't covered in buildings. They didn't have any of useful sand to make concrete left, so they now import it from places like China, and particularly Australia, to build that building and to make that glass. So there is a global trade in sand going on background that you're probably not aware of.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And also, you would never, to my mind, smoother sand would be better, right? But I guess you can't make sandcastles with smooth sand either.
Very true. Yeah. So, yeah, you won't see it, but a little picture here. So if you looked under a microscope at sand from the desert, it would look really round and it wouldn't have any jagged edges. But if you took some from the beach, or you took some that you'd scooped off the bottom of the ocean floor, it would look a bit more like a kind of salt grain. It's kind of jaggedy and rough, and those bits will stick together really well, and they'll stick together with the other stuff in cement, the smaller particles.
And so actually, if you had both types of sand, could you feel the difference? Or is it on such a small scale you couldn't tell?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, if I had to quiz you on how big you thought a sand grain was, would you have an idea?
I'm not sure. That's a good point. I think I keep thinking about, like, I've sat on many beaches and I should know this, and I really don't know.
Small enough to get everywhere.
Yes, exactly. I would have gone bigger than I don't know. A micron? I don't know.
Well, so, you know, yeah, micron. So bigger than 63 microns,
okay.
And less than 2 millimetres. So for people not familiar with microns, that's 0.0625 millimetres up to 2 millimetres.
That's actually pretty big.
Yeah. Okay. And beyond 2 millimetres, so this is very, well, it's very interesting to a geek like me.
Yeah.
Bigger than sand, it becomes gravel or granules. And bigger than that is a pebble. Bigger than that is a cobble, like a cob, like a roly-dee. Bigger than that is a boulder. And smaller than sand is called silt. So less than your 63 microns, that's silt.
And actually, I have always just thought silt was sandy water. So now I know what silt is. No, that's good to know. And also, yeah, I never stopped to think about what the distinction was between a pebble and a cobble.
Yes.
Which makes sense, yeah, that someone has gone out and done this. Yeah. So you were saying you work a lot, you're interested in deserts and that kind of thing. What does your day-to-day work actually involve? Like, do you go out to deserts and look there, or what do you actually do?
Yeah, so I'm lucky to have quite a varied job. It all starts with taking a field trip to a desert, which is something that I really enjoy doing. It's definitely a perk of the job. Go to a desert, find some sand dunes that I want to know something about in terms of the age of the sediment or the chemistry of the moisture in those sand dunes, and I start digging a big hole. with some auguring equipment and try to get down maybe 12 metres, 15 metres to collect different units, because every unit with depth is going to have a different bit of information from a previous point in time stored in it. I'll take a lot of samples, wrapped up in bits of black drain pipe, wrapped in bags, and bring it back to laboratories. And in the laboratories, I'll be trying to work out a couple of things. One is how long some of that sand's been buried underground. And the way you do that is actually quite funky. You heat up or you shine a blue light on some sand that you've kept in the dark, and it will glow. And the amount it glows will be proportional to how long it's been buried underground. So minerals like quartz work a bit like a rechargeable battery. When they're exposed to radiation, so anything underground is getting all the time bombarded with radiation from the decay of uranium, thorium and potassium. As it does that to a sand grain, to a piece of quartz, electrons are moving around, being giving energy, and they move around and then they get stuck in these little defects in quartz. And they keep getting full through time as it's buried. You keep it dark, bring it back to the lab, shine a light on it or heat it up, and those electrons get energy again, and they move from high energy to low energy, and in doing so, they've got to do something with that energy. So they spit out a photon, which is light. So the amount of light that's coming out of your heated sand grain in the lab is telling you how many hundreds, potentially of thousands of years, your sand grain's been buried and when it last saw the sunlight. So every time it sees light, it loses its signal, builds up the signal when it's dark, when it's buried, expose it to light again in the lab, and you let out that light signal to tell you how long it's been buried underground.
Wow, I never, honestly, you are blowing my mind. I never knew sand was so interesting. Sorry. I know it's your research, so it must be. That's amazing. And so, one last question. I was thinking, because when I think of a desert and I think of kind of the sand blowing around, as you were saying, to me that sounds like a really dynamic environment. But like, over what kind of timescales do you see significant change?
Sure, okay, yeah, so I guess the last really big change, we were talking before about the Green Sahara. Over those sort of timescales, we're talking, so 6,000 years ago and then maybe something like 27,000 years ago, and we keep going back in 21,000 year cycles. That's a big cycle where we see wetter in deserts recurring every 21,000 years, to do with the way that our orbit around the sun has changed. So we do various things in our orbit around the sun in terms of how tilty, so how much the North Pole points towards the North Star or not, so how what our axis is doing. But also we change in terms of whether we've taken an elliptical shape or a circular shape around the sun, and that orbit has stretched and squeezed. So as these things have changed, the amount of tilt, the amount of circular or elliptical, but also there's a kind of wobble. Our Earth is like a spinning top. So sometimes we're pointing towards the North Star, sometimes in the other direction, over 21,000 years. These cycles all have an influence on how much energy we receive at the surface of the Earth. And when the parameters are right and we're receiving more energy over these desert regions, it's changing the amount of moisture that gets pulled onto the land from the ocean through things like monsoons, and gives us wetter conditions in deserts. So the way we're going around the sun has a control on terrestrial climate and how wet and dry deserts are in the past.
Oh, wow. I love that. And I also love that you've brought it back to astronomy right at the end. That's fantastic. Well, thank you for coming on the Jodcast.
Great to talk to you.
And I hope you have a good weekend. Thanks.